Hello, and welcome to Western Veterinary Perspectives. This podcast, produced by the Western Canadian Animal Health Network, is intended to share information about animal health and infectious disease risks with veterinarians and producers in Western Canada. In this episode, we'll be discussing zoonotic diseases of small ruminants, diseases that can be shared between sheep, goats, other small ruminants, and humans. These should be on the radar for anyone who works regularly with sheep or goats, producers and veterinarians alike. My name is Dr. Kate Todd, and today I'll be speaking with Dr. Fabian Uhlinger, an associate professor in the Department of Large Animal Clinical Sciences at the University of Saskatchewan. Dr. Uhlinger teaches in the areas of large animal internal medicine, with a particular focus on food and production animals. She has a special interest as well in diseases of dairy calves and in small ruminant and camelid health.
Thanks for joining me today, Dr. Uhlinger.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Todd.
So farm life and animal production, for any species, it isn't ever truly completely sanitary. There's a lot of manure and dirt and all sorts of things in the environment that can make health and disease management an ongoing challenge. For producers who are working with sheep or goats or other small ruminants, what are some ways that they might be exposed to zoonotic diseases?
Yeah, there are certainly multiple ways how someone working with small ruminants may be exposed to zoonotic diseases, which are the diseases that are spread from animal to people. And probably some of the most common ways I can think of is through direct contact. So we're touching the animal, we're taking care of it, and that could lead directly to maybe an infection at the site of that contact. So I might be thinking of some skin diseases where our hands or arms or maybe faces are exposed. But it's also possible that we're essentially contaminating our hands with bodily secretions from the animal, such as urine or feces or birth fluids. And then, of course, from there, a lot of us frequently touch our faces or mouth, or we rub our eyes. And that could lead to accidental ingestion, maybe of the pathogen, or rubbing it into our mucous membranes. I think we've certainly learned the importance of hand washing and not touching our face and mouth during this recent pandemic. So this is a similar aspect here when we talk about potential disease transmission from small ruminants. Another way could be through inhalation. So maybe the pathogen from the animal is actually contained within air droplets around us, or maybe contained in dust particles in the environment as well. And similar to, you know, the risk of contracting flu or a cold from someone who sneezes and coughs, there could potentially be the risk there for getting diseases from a sheep and goat that way as well. Another really important aspect is the potential for disease transmission through contaminated food and also water, but predominantly milk and dairy products, if we think of small ruminants. So either because these products are contaminated or because maybe the animal is directly shedding the pathogen into, for example, the milk. And if we're not careful with properly cooking, for example, meat or boiling the milk or pasteurizing the milk, then there is the risk for certain disease transmissions for sure. An indirect way of contracting disease could simply be from, you know, the animal contaminates certain equipment in the barn environment and we're touching that equipment. And then again, if we're not paying really close attention to proper hand hygiene, then we could expose ourselves that way as well. Lastly, maybe there are certain diseases that are vector-borne, meaning that maybe ticks could spread them. But I think overall the sort of direct contact, handling the animal and potentially contaminated food or ingestion of dairy products and milk are probably the biggest ones that I'd worry about.
Anyone who works with sheep and goats knows that there can certainly be some seasonality to their healthcare needs. Do we see certain zoonotic diseases more at specific times of year than others?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And the first thing that comes to my mind is probably transmission of zoonotic diseases during lambing or kidding. So there are a number of diseases that sheep and goats may have and that are a danger to people. And they are predominantly transmitted through the birth fluids or placenta at the time of lambing or kidding, or if the animal aborts. So the seasonality there is probably largely related to the producer's time of kidding or lambing. In many production sites in Western Canada, that is certainly around spring. Some producers will also have a similar risk maybe in the fall if they have a more intense production system. The other potential risk period could be certain diseases are associated with feed, and I'm thinking, for example, of listeriosis, which is predominantly transmitted by feeding improperly fermented silage. And so we would probably see that type of disease more commonly at a time of the year where silage feeding is more common, so probably during the winter period, because obviously in Western Canada we have very, very long periods where we need to feed stored feed, and so the risk for listeriosis goes up in that time period. Other than that, I don't believe that there are specific seasons, but I'd say the lambing or kidding period would be the biggest one that we would have to worry about.
So you spoke about some changes that might happen in the winter months. I know that respiratory diseases can be particularly challenging for sheep and goat herds in the winter when they are spending more time indoors. Are any of these respiratory diseases of these animals zoonotic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The good news is that no. In general, when we think of the classical respiratory diseases that sheep and goats may get, and I'm thinking mostly of diseases such as pasteurilosis or Mannheimia, which are the typical bacterial pathogens that can wreak really badly, great havoc in some small ruminant herds. When we think of those, then there really is no significant concerns of transmission to people. Small ruminants are, like cattle, for example, susceptible to tuberculosis, which obviously is present in certain pockets of Saskatchewan. However, as a whole, overall, respiratory disease and risk of transmission to people from small ruminants is probably very, very minimal.
And how about COVID-19? Do we know anything about this in small ruminants? Is it a disease that we have to worry about transmitting or getting from sheep and goats?
Yeah, of course, that's a very timely question. The bottom line probably is that we certainly don't have enough systematic testing and information to absolutely confidently say yes or no to this question. Based on the relatively crude information that we generally have, we do not currently believe that sheep and goats are a risk to people in terms of transmitting coronavirus that's causing COVID disease. According to the Government of Canada, there have been no reports of livestock such as cows, pigs, goats, or sheep that have been naturally infected with the virus. There is some concern about some of the wildlife species, such as maybe mink, cougars, and white-tailed deer, but bottom line is that at this point, based on the information that we have, we do not specifically worry about COVID transmission from small ruminants.
We'll get into some of the nitty-gritty here. I'm curious in regards to manure and manure management then, because this is a constant reality for anyone who's working in animal production. Can you tell us about some diseases that might be spread to humans from sheep or goats via contact with manure?
Yeah, probably the two most significant ones we'd be concerned about are Salmonella and Campylobacter. They are both important pathogens for causing so-called foodborne illnesses in people because they not uncommonly contaminate our food supply if processing is unhygienic, but it's obviously possible that it is also directly transmitted from a sheep or a goat that is shedding these pathogens in the manure. And then, as I said earlier on, if we're not careful with practicing some good hygiene, then we are at risk for those diseases. So Salmonella in sheep and goats would cause abortion predominantly in the pregnant sheep. In lambs and kids, it certainly also can cause quite severe clinical disease with regards to diarrhea, fever, joint ill. So oftentimes that results in a syndrome that we call sepsis. And similarly in people then, if we're ingesting, if we're contaminating our hands and maybe we're touching our mouth or we're going from the barn to the kitchen and we're preparing a salad for supper and we're not washing our hands properly, there is the risk of transmission. And in people, salmonellosis predominantly manifests as an abdominal disease. So severe abdominal pain, fever, headache. It's generally an acute disease, so it's not something you're waiting for to show clinical signs for a long period of time. Campylobacter is very similar, really, in the sense that it predominantly causes abortion or also birth of weak lambs in sheep and also goats, although abortion seems to be a bit more common in sheep than it is in goats. But again, especially younger lambs and kids can get really sick with diarrhea and fever from Campylobacter. And similarly to salmonellosis, campylobacteriosis in people is also generally characterized by abdominal pain, quite severe abdominal pain, diarrhea and fever, vomiting, kind of the more typical clinical signs that maybe we might think of with acute food poisoning, but often a bit more severe with also having fever and just generally feeling quite debilitated. So these risks are there, and certainly we worry about those, especially in children, for example, but also immunocompromised individuals. And so again, proper hand washing, good hygiene, and, you know, good manure management are certainly important in those aspects.
Lambing and kitting, they come along with their own set of joys and stresses, but they also can pose some risk to people who are assisting with birthing or handling newborns or maybe aborted fetuses. What diseases are risky in these scenarios for potential zoonotic spread?
Yes, I think when we talk about zoonotic diseases in small ruminants, this is definitely the most important and probably also the biggest category of diseases, which are those that cause abortion. There are a number of those, and some of which come to my mind are chlamydophila. So we also refer to chlamydophila abortus as enzootic abortion of ewes. Campylobacter, as I just previously mentioned, is also an important one. Q fever, toxoplasmosis, and listeriosis. So there's a relatively big list of conditions that we need to be worried about. I will talk about each of those briefly in a moment, but just in terms of, you know, how common do we actually know these diseases are, just to give the listener a bit of an understanding. So a study conducted in Saskatchewan in 2014 found that out of 44 submissions, so that wasn't a huge study, but out of 44 submissions of sheep abortion materials, about 50% of those were actually due to chlamydophila, or the pathogen that causes enzootic abortion in ewes. And if we look a little bit further to the west in Alberta, there was a study around the same time. And similarly there, chlamydophila was also the most common cause of abortion in sheep there, followed by campylobacter. And that study also specifically looked at goats, and it actually found a very low prevalence or occurrence of Q fever in goats there. The situation is slightly different maybe in Ontario, if we have listeners maybe from the east. So there was a similar study where they also looked at abortion submissions in sheep. They had about 163 submissions. And essentially, they found predominantly the pathogen Toxoplasma gondii at 33%, and then Campylobacter, and then Chlamydophila. So it was a little bit of a reversal based on what we found in the West, but we have to take that with a bit of a grain of salt because, you know, it depends a bit on the number of samples that we're looking at as well. But this is just to highlight that definitely these pathogens are present in our sheep and also goat population in Canada. And we certainly have some good information from Western Canada that producers should be concerned about a number of those conditions. In terms of clinical signs in both sheep and goats, ultimately what we're seeing with all of those conditions is abortion, or at least reproductive failure. So in some situations, maybe the producer will not specifically see the aborted fetus, but will just have a number of ewes or does that did not get pregnant this time around. With the enzootic abortion in ewes, which is the Chlamydophila abortus pathogen, which is a bacterium, we generally see late-term abortion. So the animal is pregnant, goes through a relatively normal pregnancy, but then unfortunately aborts in late pregnancy, or even gives birth to a stillborn lamb, or gives birth to a weak and low-weight lamb or kid. The risk is that people get infected when they're assisting, maybe with lambing or kitting, or by obviously removing the aborted birth tissues. And usually what we would see in those situations in people that do get infected is essentially flu-like symptoms. So they'd have a bit of a headache, fever, some joint pain, chills. Maybe it goes as far as developing pneumonia. So it's relatively nonspecific, and many of us, you know, would not necessarily think of this being anything more than maybe a flu or a headache. The biggest risk with many of those, I want to say this right from the start, is that a lot of these pathogens can also cause abortion in pregnant women. And so the bottom line is ultimately that any female that is pregnant should not be around kitting or lambing use or dose because of the risk that there are pathogens maybe in the herd or the flock that may cause abortion in the pregnant woman. Similarly, with Campylobacter, again, the signs are similar to enzootic abortion in use. So we generally deal with a late-term abortion or maybe the birth of weak lambs or simply increased neonatal lamb or kid mortality. We may, with Campylobacter, the problem there is a little bit that the sheep, when it's pregnant, when it gets sick with Campylobacter, it essentially is a systemic illness. So the sheep is sick, it has fever, it's not feeling well, and then abortion happens essentially later on as a consequence of being systemically sick. It's not necessarily that the Campylobacter infects just the placenta, but the systemic illness that it causes in the sheep, which is generally a GI disease, gastrointestinal disease, can result ultimately in abortion. With Campylobacteriosis in people, as I've mentioned earlier when we talked about the risk of disease coming from manure, clinical signs are generally abdominal pain, diarrhea, fever, vomiting. So again, really just feeling very, very yucky and having gastrointestinal disease. And again, there is a risk for abortion to any person that may be pregnant and in contact with these infected animals. Toxoplasma is a really interesting pathogen. So Toxoplasma gondii is a tiny parasite that has an interesting and rather complex life cycle. The thing to know about Toxoplasma is that it is essentially transmitted by cats that defecate into feed and water sources if they have opportunity to or don't have an alternative. And then small ruminants ingest that parasite, and it may cause infection of the placenta with subsequent abortion. The interesting aspect about this is that the problem is greatest if the sheep and goats have not previously been exposed to Toxoplasma. So that would be considered a naive sheep and goat, and they are at greatest risk. If an older ewe or doe has been exposed to Toxoplasma at some point when she wasn't pregnant, she generally has a good amount of immunity and it will not affect her in subsequent pregnancies. So it's the first time around if a sheep or goat is exposed to Toxoplasma and if she is pregnant at the time, that it can unfortunately result in problems with the pregnancy. What the producer sees with toxoplasmosis in their pregnant sheep or goats depends a bit on the stage of pregnancy at time of infection. So in the early stages, the sheep or goat may simply absorb the fetus, so the fetus may just die and, you know, we end up with an open ewe or doe. Sort of in the mid-stage of the pregnancy, it can result in fetal death that is then aborted at a later stage. So we would see abortion, and in even later pregnancy, so third trimester, we may see premature, stillborn, or weak lambs and goat kids being born. So not necessarily abortion, but abnormally weak lambs and kids. And again, people become infected by being exposed to the birth fluids or to the abortion materials if improperly handled and not enough protective equipment are being worn. One thing to mention here is probably that the risk of transmission of Toxoplasma from infected small ruminants to people is generally not that big in comparison to cleaning out your cat's litter box or improperly washing garden vegetables that may have been contaminated with cat feces. So I'd like to be clear that yes, there is a risk, but there's probably other situations that might pose a far greater risk. The good news is that most people that become infected with toxoplasmosis will actually never know. And they're what we consider asymptomatic. They may maybe transiently develop some mild flu-like symptoms, But in most situations, toxoplasmosis does not really result in clinical signs. The problem is predominantly in very young individuals or in immunocompromised individuals, where toxoplasmosis can result in severe eye, brain, and disease of other organs. And again, going to the pregnant person, the pregnant woman, if that person becomes infected with toxoplasmosis for the first time in her life when she is pregnant, there is the risk of severe brain damage to her child. And bottom line there again is for pregnant women to stay away from lambing ewes and kidding does. Another disease that I've mentioned earlier is Q fever. So Q stands for query, because when the disease was first noticed, probably close to 60 years ago, I believe, it wasn't clear what it was or where it came from. So that's where the query comes from. And it is a disease in people that is caused by a bacterium called Coxiella burnettii. Similar to all the other pathogens that I've just talked about, it can cause abortion in sheep and goats, including stillbirth, as well as birth of weak lambs and kids. Not every person that gets Q fever will get sick, so about 5 out of 10 people may actually get sick. And again, similar to Chlamydophila, for example, Q fever is characterized by relatively non-specific clinical signs, such as fevers, chills, fatigue, headache, muscle aches, and the severity of signs will vary a little bit. It is possible that a chronic form of Q fever develops months or years later. And the significance there is that it could potentially affect the heart and cause endocarditis, which is an inflammation of the heart valves. So people can be exposed to Q fever when handling infected materials at birth. So whether that's the placenta, whether it is an aborted fetus, or just simply contaminating their hands and face with the birth fluid and ingesting it or potentially even inhaling it that way. And the other important thing about Q fever is that infected sheep and goats can actually shed the bacterium in their urine and feces for days around parturition. So here's certainly one pathogen that could result to also foodborne disease if the milk is not properly processed from an animal that is shedding it. And so consumption of unpasteurized milk or dairy products could also be a concern. There certainly are reports of Q fever in people every year in Canada. And interestingly, and I'm not sure what the significance is of that, but in the last year or two, I've certainly heard of more producers than before actually being diagnosed with Q fever. So again, we do have those diseases present in our sheep and goat population. Lastly, and I understand that this is a big question because there are quite a lot of pathogens, but I do think it's really important to talk about those. Another disease that I just like to highlight is listeriosis, which also can cause abortion. I've previously briefly talked about listeriosis in the context of maybe seasonality. It's generally associated with feeding silage. And some producers may know listeriosis as the circling disease because it certainly quite commonly causes neurologic disease in sheep and goats, in which case they circle, they're blind, they have maybe a droopy face. But again, if the animal is also pregnant at that time, then it certainly can cause abortion as well. And like all the other diseases, listeria can be transmitted to people if they get in contact with the abortion material, but it is also a relatively common foodborne pathogen. So when people consume milk or dairy products from infected animals or which have not been properly pasteurized or also contaminated meat that is then undercooked or uncooked. So maybe to briefly summarize, there are a number of diseases that especially come from sheep and goats that are pregnant and maybe infected with those conditions, and they cause abortion in sheep and goats, but unfortunately can also cause abortion in pregnant women. So really important for pregnant women to stay away from lambing ewes and lambing does. Best to just stay away and to really practice good hygiene and wear proper protective equipment, wear gloves, dedicated clothing, and wash hands really well. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about some of the other measures that we can take to protect ourselves.
Yes, it is really so critical. And I know it's even more of an issue now, I think, in small ruminants, because we do see a lot of female producers raising small ruminants. And certainly we see a lot of female veterinarians now as well. I remember speaking about these risks during my veterinary training, and there's not a perfect solution for it if, you know, you're in a field where you do have to be involved in working day to day with these animals. Are there any specific measures that producers can take to protect themselves from these reproductive diseases of sheep and goats?
Yeah, there are a number of measures that producers can take, not just, I would say, to protect themselves from the reproductive diseases, but in general. The big overarching term probably would be biosecurity. So biosecurity entails anything that deals with trying to reduce the risk of disease transmission, either within the herd, into the herd, or from the herd to someone else. And so a very basic aspect of biosecurity is simply to practice good hygiene on the premises, as I've mentioned before, to really pay attention to having clean pens, proper manure disposal, regular cleaning, regular disinfecting of dirty premises and pens as well. Good husbandry or good biosecurity also means that the very best thing a producer can do is to try and to not buy in animals of unknown disease status. So in an ideal world, a producer would try and have what we call a closed herd, where essentially all replacements come from within that herd. And hopefully the only thing that needs to come in from the outside would be the odd ram or buck every once in a while. And there the focus should be on getting rams or bucks that are from well-managed, high biosecure farms with essentially known disease status or having specifically tested for certain diseases. The next important thing is that if new animals have to be acquired, that they're being isolated for at least 14 days to A, monitor their health status, but also to potentially conduct certain diagnostics to rule out certain diseases. And along the same lines, anytime an animal is sick, to separate that from the other animals to immediately try and reduce any potential transmission. The other thing I would strongly recommend is that producers really make an effort to investigate abortions if they occur on their farm. That does not necessarily mean that every single abortion immediately has to be investigated. Obviously, you know, sometimes there's just bad luck there and there are maybe non-infectious causes that have contributed to an abortion. But what we do recommend is that, you know, a producer essentially in advance decides what their threshold might be for intervention if abortions do occur. And so on some farms, that's after 3 abortions have occurred. That's when they start investigating, or after 3% of the lambing animals have aborted, that's when they start investigating. And so keeping aborted fetuses and aborted placenta and freezing them in case they are needed later for submission to the lab would be a really good recommendation I'd like to make. Also, disposing of aborted tissues promptly and correctly by actually double bagging it, burying it, burning it, really ensuring that scavenging animals and household pets cannot have access to it and potentially disperse pathogens that way. The same obviously goes for any dead stock. We don't know necessarily the disease status of dead stock and we want to avoid potential disease spread. Specifically to reduce the risk of toxoplasmosis, we'd like to keep cats away from feed sources, obviously dogs as well, just for general hygiene purposes. And there's other diseases that dogs can transmit, maybe not necessarily zoonotic ones, but keep cats away from feed sources as best as possible. That can obviously be difficult because a lot of farms obviously have cats roaming around. But some ways to reduce the risk of toxoplasmosis transmission could be to actually offer litter boxes to encourage defecation in dedicated area as opposed to all over the place, and to also ensure that the cats are actually fed proper cat food so that maybe they don't need to hunt as many rodents, which are unfortunately intermediate hosts for toxoplasmosis. So those are ways to limit exposure to that. Wearing dedicated protective equipment, as I said earlier, essentially ideally anytime when handling animals, but definitely around lambing and kidding. So that would be wearing gloves, wearing dedicated clothing, potentially also even go as far as wearing a face mask, especially with some of the pathogens that can be a risk of inhalation, or even just, we've again learned from COVID, having a face mask will obviously generally prevent you from putting your hands on your mouth or in your mouth. So that could be a great protective measure. And definitely practice good hand washing and good hygiene. Do not consume unpasteurized dairy products or undercooked meat. So there is a risk for diseases like listeriosis, Q fever, or Campylobacter. Another way how a producer could limit or reduce the risk of disease transmission is to vaccinate against some of the diseases. Unfortunately, we really only have two vaccines available against two of those conditions. So we have a vaccine for use in sheep against Chlamydophila abortus, so the enzootic abortion in use, and against Campylobacter. And in those farms where these pathogens have been present and have been a problem in the past, vaccination could certainly be indicated. So I recommend to any producer to speak with their veterinarian about that. For goats, we're a little bit limited, unfortunately, simply because there are virtually no vaccines labeled for use in goats, and we're not supposed to use vaccines extra label. I do again encourage any goat producer to otherwise have a conversation with their veterinarian. And then just overall good herd flock health with regards to adequate and balanced nutrition, and also attention to proper ensiling processes if silage is being fed to the animals, just to limit the risk of listeriosis. I came across an interesting little, I'm not sure what you call it, mnemonic. It's called NO, and I'm not sure who to credit for that specifically, but essentially the K in NO stands for know that animals carry germs that can make people sick. N, never eat, drink, or put things into your mouth in animal areas. O, so from no, older adults, pregnant women, and young children should be extra careful around animals or potentially stay away completely. And the W in no is for wash your hands with soap and water right after visiting the animal area. No, I think if we keep those in mind, then we have some good basic biosecurity. Lastly, maybe what I'd like to say here is too that both the Canadian sheep and the goat industries, the national associations, they do have biosecurity programs available that goat producers and sheep producers can sign up to. And I encourage any producer to consider participating in those. So for the sheep, that's called the Canadian Verified Sheep Program. And for the goats, it's called the Goat On-Farm Food Safety Program. And following these programs will automatically assure a certain a level of biosecurity that provides a higher quality product.
I was thinking a little bit as you were talking and reviewing those things there regarding biosecurity, that it might be worth mentioning how we can transmit disease via fomites. I was just thinking about washing, you know, coveralls, for example, or doing laundry, even for someone else who had been handling birthing fluids or fetuses or anything. There would be some potential risk there, even if a person wasn't directly handling the animals. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I probably didn't stress that enough. Absolutely. And so again, it's all about this being aware. Yeah, it's all about this being aware that even the pregnant person, you know, that might not be around the animals, but maybe doing some of the other chores, is still at risk. And when we talk about fomites, again, this is also just general feeding equipment and cleaning equipment, and paying attention to cleaning and disinfecting those is obviously really important. But yes, thanks for pointing that out, Dr. Todd.
It is pretty common as well. You did mention younger farmhands there, and I know they may take up some of these tasks on farm, like feeding or milking. What health precautions might be specific to ensure that children stay safe from zoonotic diseases of sheep and goats?
Yeah. I mean, having a toddler myself, I think preventing them from sticking their hands in their mouth is a huge task. And also, you know, lambs and kits are super cute, so we all want to cuddle those and probably bury our face in their necks. And that's obviously not ideal or less than ideal in any situation. I don't know that I have a very specific recommendation other than speaking to the children about the potential risks and obviously monitoring, because the child isn't going to understand when you try and explain at a high level what the risks are, right? But modeling the behavior around the animals by putting on gloves, by making a point at washing hands, by really being aware and inform children that, you know, hands don't go in the mouth when they are around the barn or around the animals. That is the best that I can think of. And to try not to have them kiss the goat kid.
So occasionally we may see sheep or goats that show some signs of neurologic disease. And I think this is worth mentioning just because it is always such a big potential red flag. So some of these signs could include things like circling that you mentioned that might be typical for listeriosis, maybe some head pressing, weakness or poor coordination, acute blindness, or maybe excessive drooling or bawling. I know there's at least a few major zoonotic diseases that we as veterinarians need to keep at the top of our mind if we see livestock that are showing these symptoms. Could you mention a few of these and maybe how they're spread and why they're of potential concern for people?
Yeah, for sure. The two diseases that come to my mind when I think of neurologic disease in small ruminants and zoonosis are, as you said, listeriosis. I think that would be a big one. And then also rabies. As I said, listeriosis is a bacterium. It's called Listeria monocytogenes. And it is quite common in the environment. It's not anything particularly special. It can be found in soil, plants, muds, and stream. It's relatively resistant to freezing and cold, but it can be killed by drying out, pasteurization, or cooking, and that's important to know. Sheep and goats mostly get infected, as I've said, through eating contaminated silage. That's probably the most common way. They can also ingest it simply from it's present in the soil. It's also possible there are reports of transmission through hay. But generally, if silage is contaminated, but that silage ferments properly and the pH drops enough, then essentially Listeria gets killed. The problem is when the silage is spoiled and for some reason the pH isn't dropping enough, in which case the pathogen can survive. And what we might see in those situations where an animal has listeriosis, apart from maybe the abortion that may occur in pregnant animals, as you said, the animal may show some compulsive circling. So it'll keep on circling to a site no matter what you try and do. Even if you try and sort of stop it and move it in the other direction, it'll automatically go back to circling in sort of that one direction. It may be head pressing. They may be blind and just be staggering around, so have an uncoordinated gait. In people, the most common cause of listeriosis is ingestion of contaminated food products. So that would probably be the biggest one, apart from, yes, there is that risk of contaminating listeriosis if the animal aborts and we're not careful around that time. But generally, listeriosis is principally transmitted if people ingest contaminated or unpasteurized milk or dairy products or contaminated and undercooked meat. I mean, every once in a while, this is in the news, right? Some people may have heard of listeriosis outbreaks also in association with eating contaminated produce, such as some sprouts or melons. Usually, the clinical signs in people suffering from listeriosis, so I've never seen a person with listeriosis, I hope I never will, but it may include diarrhea, headache, vomiting, fever, abdominal pain. So again, relatively nonspecific. And in pregnant women, again, abortion or potentially premature birth. So the association there is mostly that, again, people need to be aware, because I think, you know, many of us don't necessarily think too long and hard if we have a bit of a GI upset or a little bit of fever. But if signs persist or they really get to a point where it's this seems beyond sort of just a bit of a flu, and maybe we can make that mental association that, well, wait, you know, I just was dealing with this animal, or I just assisted in kidding, or my ewe just aborted, then we really need to make that link in those situations. Another zoonotic disease, as I said, that comes to my mind when I think of a neurologic small ruminant would be rabies. So rabies, many of us are familiar with rabies to a certain extent. It is caused by a virus called Lyssa virus, and rabies really can infect almost all mammals. So in farm animals in North America, frequently wildlife is the source of rabies. Many of us know about rabies from potential transmission through dog bites. That would probably be a common one that we're familiar with. Farm animals more commonly probably would get rabies through a bite from a wildlife animal such as a skunk and fox and raccoon, to mention some that are present in Western Canada here. There is bat associated rabies, but as a whole, probably transmission from an infected wildlife, from an infected mammal such as skunk, foxes and raccoons would probably be more common. Of course, the farm dog could also have rabies and be transmitting rabies. That would be, you know, a really unfortunate situation. I've said multiple times now, transmission is through the bite from an infected animal. The virus is generally shed in the saliva. And so with a dog or with an animal bite, that's how the virus essentially would get transmitted into the small ruminant. In people, again, I think I'd like to stress that rabies, if anything, is probably more commonly transmitted to people from potentially household pets, like from dogs themselves, maybe through the bite of a fox. I think it is not that common to get rabies from a small ruminant per se, but the risk certainly is there. A small ruminant that has rabies shows a variety of clinical signs, or may show a variety of clinical signs. So the clinical signs may actually start relatively subtle, with the animal just being a little bit off, a bit depressed, maybe not quite eating as much. And maybe the really astute owner might notice that it's a bit uncoordinated. What is relatively common are changes in behavior. So the animal may suddenly or uncharacteristically be apprehensive, or actually the opposite, become quite aggressive. It may be really hyper excitable out of nowhere. There may be excessive drooling because there is increasing paralysis of the swallow apparatus, and animals aren't able to swallow that much anymore. So there's increasing drooling. They may just overall be abnormally nervous or seek solitude. So it's mostly that change in character and behavior that people may notice because they know their animal. They're like, this is unusual. There may also be spontaneous muscle twitching. So the animal may be standing there and just be twitching random muscles. And there may also be changes to the vocal sound. So if an animal is vocal, that sound may really change to becoming a lot more hoarse or high-pitched or just interrupted. And then, unfortunately, the disease is always fatal. And it usually progresses quite rapidly and will result in paralysis and eventually death. So this occurs over a period of days and not weeks or months. As I said, people could get infected if they get bitten by the sheep or goat. Generally, we don't really worry too much, or at least I don't worry too much about being bitten by a sheep or goat, because biting is not really a sheep or goat's primary defense mechanism, in contrast to, for example, a dog. But because the rabies virus infects the brain and changes an animal's behavior, accidental biting is certainly an option or a possibility when we're trying to care for this rabid animal and may not immediately think of the animal having rabies. So the other option is, it doesn't necessarily have to be an actual bite. It's also possible that saliva simply contaminates a small skin abrasion that we may have anywhere in our body, in our hands, and that's how the pathogen, the virus, can also enter our body. Any person that is concerned about having had potential rabies exposure should really immediately contact a physician and discuss their concerns. There is so-called post-exposure prophylaxis immunizations available for unvaccinated individuals that have been exposed to rabies. Unfortunately, rabies diagnosis in the diseased animal is only possible after death. So any animal that has a suspicion of rabies either must be humanely destroyed, or in most situations will die and must be submitted for a necropsy. And We generally await the necropsy results to obviously determine the next steps for the person, but that's a public health issue that public health would deal with. It is really important that any person who has any concerns about having potential contact with a rabies animal should seek a physician and consult with them about that. And I think in terms of neurologic diseases that are zoonotic, those are probably the two biggest ones that I'd like producers to be aware of.
Yeah, that raises two points too in my mind. So one of them would be that if you do have an animal that is displaying neurologic signs and is euthanized or does pass away, every time I've always heard pathologists grumble if they receive an animal for a postmortem and they do not receive the head of the animal, they really, really want to make sure that the entire carcass, including the head, is submitted for a postmortem, particularly for those cases. Just as you mentioned earlier, the importance of submitting both an aborted fetus along with the placenta. Those are two common gripes that I hear from those folks trying to do some diagnostics in laboratories. The other thing I was going to mention there is it is so important that as producers and veterinarians, we do bring some of these concerns forward to our own physicians because it may not be top of mind for them to consider some of the zoonotic risks that are posed by our occupations. So just certainly to make sure that your own physicians and family doctors are informed of your work as a producer and some of those potential exposures that you may have is really important, I think. You did mention that listeriosis was one zoonotic pathogen that could be spread through milk or ingestion of unpasteurized milk products or unpasteurized fresh cheeses. Are there any others that we need to worry about through consumption of dairy products from sheep or goats?
Quite a few of the ones that I've mentioned earlier that also cause abortion are actually also a concern for contaminating milk or cheese or for being spread through the milk and then obviously potentially ending up in cheese. So listeriosis is one of them. Q fever and Campylobacter would be two other important ones that I'd like to highlight. Another one that I haven't quite mentioned yet would be Casey's lymphadenitis, which is a disease caused by a bacterium called Carinobacterium pseudotuberculosis. This condition causes abscesses in sheep and goats, but it can also spread through the milk, and so unpasteurized dairy products can also be problematic. In people specifically with Casey's lymphadenitis caused by Carinobacterium pseudotuberculosis, this condition is mostly manifested by swollen lymph nodes, could potentially lead to pneumonia. I do want to stress that it seems to be overall very rare. I have yet to meet a person that has had Casey's lymphadenitis, or at least has known to have had it. So it is overall very rare in my experience, particularly in healthy individuals. Again, immunocompromised persons or children might be at a greater risk. Another one I also haven't really talked about is brucellosis. This disease in people caused by Brucella bacteria is called indolent fever. The reason I haven't really stressed it, and I don't know that I need to stress it, but I just want to have it mentioned, is that although it may occur in Canada, the disease is actually really rare, and Canadian livestock are considered free of brucellosis overall. So it is not a disease that we tend to see. So the last reported cases that I'm aware of, based on perusing some government websites, is actually in Saskatchewan in 1989. So it's not a condition that we generally worry about. But again, it the potential for the disease is always somewhere. And together with other more common diseases such as listeriosis, Q fever, and Campylobacter, all of which are absolutely present in our sheep and goat populations, I really caution anyone against consuming raw milk and raw dairy products, and also against consuming undercooked or improperly prepared meat, and to just generally practice really good food preparation hygiene in the kitchen.
And I think just to sort of complete our syndromic scan, I guess, of body systems and what we might be exposed to, there are a few skin rashes or skin infections that perhaps we should be aware of.
Absolutely, yes. And the most common one is probably ORF. Some people may know it as contagious ecthyma or sore mouth or scabby mouth would be also very common names for this disease. ORF is caused by a virus and is transmitted to people essentially via direct contact from the infected sheep or goat. In sheep and goats, it's predominantly what we kind of refer to as a childhood disease. So it's a disease of the lambs and the kids. And a lot of producers, I am sure, will have seen it because it's quite common. The lambs and kids develop scabby lesions around their mouth, so essentially at any of the mucocutaneous junctions and mucosa. These scabby lesions can develop around the mouth, muzzle, nose. It can also spread to the legs and around the coronary band. And adult animals can also have it on their teats. The good news with ORF, and again, that's kind of why we call it a bit of a childhood disease. It's one of those diseases that young kids and lambs tend to go to in those premises where the virus is present. So it's quite common. It is generally self-limiting, and usually we really don't need to intervene and do anything about it. It'll essentially just go away. There are some situations where an animal may be so severely affected that it may be really painful to get around if the lesions are around the coronary band. It's more commonly also potentially that it just has a really hard time nursing or eating because of the lesions around the mouth. And so those might be situations where we may intervene and to support this animal. There's also the risk for secondary bacterial infections. So again, in some situations, these animals need a bit of veterinary attention and additional care, but generally it is a self-limiting disease. Similarly, the same is more or less true for people. So people, as I said, can get infected by direct contact, just touching the lesions on the animal. And, you know, again, lambs and kids are super cute. We pick them up. We may feed them. So we certainly touch them a lot. And so usually ORF is confined to the skin in people, usually the fingers, hands, arms, face. It's also possible that a person just gets it from a small cut in their skin or a scratch when they come in contact with the infected animal. The disease kind of goes through different stages. Usually the skin turns a bit reddish, blue, maybe a little bit itchy and a bit tender. You might just kind of go like, what's that spot on my finger here? Then a little later, about a week or so, a blister may form and that might be oozing a little bit and then it eventually crusts over. So overall, this process tends to last about 6 weeks. I'm sure many producers that are listening probably have had ORF. Lasts for about 6 weeks, and then the lesions heal on their own and without any scarring. So that's usually the worst that most people will go through. Again, in some situations where people are immunocompromised, there could be some worse clinical signs such as fever, swollen lymph nodes, and if you feel that this is happening to you, or if the skin lesions do not disappear within a few weeks, then it's certainly time to go and see a doctor. The other good news about this disease, though, is that really an infected person does not tend to give it to another infected person. So we only get it from the animals, but we're not passing it on ourselves. There is no specific treatment, though, for ORF, neither for ourselves nor for the animals. But again, in the vast majority of cases, it's self-limiting and will just peter out and go away. Another skin disease that we can get from our sheep and goats, and that, again, I'm fairly certain quite a few producers will have had, is ringworm. It's sometimes also referred to as club lamb fungus or dermatophytosis. It is a disease that's caused by a skin fungus, essentially. It is not that common in sheep and goats, at least not in my clinical experience. I certainly see it a lot more frequently in cattle, but it is a possibility. In sheep, their thick, full wool and the lanolin, we believe, probably protects them somewhat from ringworm. But in show lambs that are obviously shorn quite frequently and quite short and are frequently washed and where the lanolin is removed, we certainly see ringworm as well, as we do in goats. Ringworm tends to affect predominantly the ears, the head, and the neck. It can be all over the body, though, so I'm always a little wary as to, you know, being very specific about where it occurs, but certainly the ears, the head, and the neck would be very characteristic. And as the name says, ringworm, it often causes ring-shaped lesions, so round patches. These are usually a little bit crusty, a little bit scaly. They're usually hairless. They're not usually that itchy or only very mildly itchy. And similar to ORF, we tend to see it more in younger animals, probably just because their immune system is still kind of working. It hasn't, or, you know, is still building up. It hasn't seen as many pathogens, and the immunity to fight that particular fungus just isn't quite there yet. So in older animals, seeing ringworm or ORF is actually relatively uncommon, unless they have some other underlying compromise that's predisposing them. Similar to ORF, people can become infected with ringworm by direct contact with the infected skin of an animal, and they'll actually develop relatively similar lesions, so kind of a red, roundish, scaly patch that might be a little bit more itchy than maybe in the animal. It could also blister with a little bit of oozing, and if it does happen on an area with some hair, so maybe facial hair or on the scalp, then we might see the more characteristic round hairless patches in people as well. Ringworm can be spread from person to person, so unlike ORF, it is possible. The good news with ringworm, again, is too that in many, many cases, it's a mild self-limiting condition. When specific treatment may be necessary, because maybe ringworm is widespread or a person has a bit of a harder time fighting it, then speaking to a pharmacist, because sometimes over-the-counter medicines are available, such as some type of an antifungal cream, or in some situations, one might need a prescription drug from a doctor. But it is generally treatable, and in most situations, actually, it goes away. I think the key to these conditions, again, is to A, be aware of them, and to potentially make that association should you develop any skin rashes or patches that you're, you know, not sure about what they are, and to obviously handle any infected animals by wearing gloves and practicing good hand washing, hygiene, and just general good hygiene. Those would be the key aspects. Compared to everything else I've said before in terms of, you know, diseases transmitted through abortions and potential food, I'd say the skin diseases are, if we have to get anything, I'd probably like to get the skin diseases. Preferably nothing, but I'd take the skin diseases over any of the other ones that I've talked about to date.
So just in our last couple of minutes here, I just want to summarize on a couple of points. So the first would be if you could perhaps tell us the top three zoonotic diseases that you think sheep and goat producers need to be aware of so that they know to head to the doctor if they have any concerns or clinical symptoms. And then the second portion of this would be, I'd like you to highlight the top biosecurity protocols that you think could be used on farm for small ruminant producers to minimize the chance of zoonotic disease spread.
When I think of the top three zoonotic diseases, I think there's a couple of ways of thinking about this question. One is to think about which zoonotic conditions are very common in small ruminants in Canada. If I look at it that way, I would probably have to say ORF as the skin condition, Casey's lymphadenitis, because it's incredibly common. And then as an overarching category, I'd say all of the abortive agents, of which Chlamydophila appears to be more common in Western Canada, maybe compared to Eastern Canada. But ultimately, to me, this is a bit of a moot point because they're all potentially dangerous. However, I have yet to actually meet a person that has had, for example, Casey's lymphadenitis. So I think that might not be the right way to think about it, even though it is a very, very common disease. So then I thought, well, maybe we should think about the most common diseases in terms of the high-risk situations. And to me, that's probably the one that makes the most sense, as opposed to focusing on three specific diseases. I would probably think to focus on three high-risk situations. And for those, to me, for both sheep and goats, really, there are three clear situations. One is the overall handling and simple touching of the animal, where we are at greatest risk of coming in contact with the skin diseases. So there is ORF, which I do think is one of the top ones, although it's the most innocuous one and probably the nicest one to get in quotation mark. The second high risk situation obviously is around lambing sheep or kidding does. So the vast majority of zoonotic pathogens we've talked about come from aborting small ruminants. So this to me is a high risk situation. To pick within that pool, really, I find a bit challenging because the risk will vary for a pregnant woman versus another healthy adult. So as a pregnant woman, certainly the abortive agents would be absolutely top of my list. For an otherwise healthy adult, I would probably be most concerned about something like Q fever, simply because of the potential longer-term effects that Q fever could have. And then the third high-risk situation, again, comes from potential consumption of improperly prepared or contaminated food and milk. And again, within that, to pick a specific disease, I'm not sure that I'm comfortable doing that because the disease risk will vary a little bit from farm to farm in terms of potential disease prevalence. But the situation of consuming improperly prepared food or unpasteurized milk or dairy products, that doesn't necessarily change. The other way I thought about this question is to actually say, well, what do we know about what are the most common diseases in terms of what's actually being reported in people? I did have a quick look at some government websites. Of course, there's a huge bias in that because many diseases will not be reported because producers will not go and seek medical assistance simply because a lot of the clinical signs are relatively vague. And although I think for some of them medical assistance will be needed, some may also just be transient and not necessarily result in disease enough for the person to go seek medical care. Secondly, we may go to the doctor and still not get the correct diagnosis. So looking at government websites, I don't think is necessarily the best way. But I did do a very quick search. And when we look at that, so Canada's Food Inspection Agency lists Campylobacter and Listeria as very common causes of food poisoning. And Campylobacter actually makes the list of the top four yearly causes of food poisoning in people in Canada, while listeriosis is the top cause of death related to food poisoning in Canada. So it doesn't occur as commonly as Campylobacter in terms of food poisoning, but when it does occur, it is more deadly than some of the other diseases. Maybe if we were to think of it in that term, then I would certainly again highlight the foodborne diseases such as Campylobacter, listeriosis as very high on my list as well.
And then for the biosecurity protocols.
Yeah, I think for the biosecurity protocol, it a lot of it goes back to pretty much what I said earlier on in terms of how can a producer try and protect themselves. The top approach is that if you do not already have those diseases in your herd or your flock, keep them out. And the way you keep them out is by having a closed herd or flock, if that is a possibility for you. Or if not, then by solely adding disease-tested animals from other high biosecure herds. That would be my top recommendation. As I said, vaccination in those situations against the couple of abortive diseases that we have a vaccine for, especially for sheep, potentially in goats. I'd certainly also encourage any producer to discuss this with their veterinarian, because even though they may not completely prevent the disease, they can contribute to greatly reducing the incidence and the occurrence of the disease. At the risk of repeating myself, pregnant women should not be anywhere near lambing sheep or kidding does. Within the farm, isolating sick animals is really, really important. And then again, really practicing general good hygiene with regular cleaning, disinfecting pens, disinfecting any equipment and materials, storing feed as securely as possible. Obviously, we can't cover everything up because the animals need to have access to it. But storing any grain away from scavenging and household pets would be really important. And then disposing of dead stock in general, not just aborted tissues, but any dead stock properly, and investigating abortions. Those would be my general recommendations for minimizing. And the next step as well is always consider whether anybody really should come near your herd or your flock, right? Do you want your neighbor or Joe down the road to come and pet your animals? So obviously having young lambs and goat kids is super cute, and sometimes people would love to make a little bit of a petting zoo out of your farm. But from a disease transmission perspective, that is probably not what you'd like to support or should support. And maybe just to briefly go back to what Dr. Todd said, I'd really do like to advocate for any producer that does develop any type of clinical signs that may be consistent with the diseases that we talked about to go seek medical care, and to not hesitate to really advocate for themselves, and I'm not sure what the right word is, but maybe push the physicians, if necessary, to pursue diagnostic for some of these conditions. Because as Dr. Todd said, some of these diseases are not necessarily always at the forefront of physicians, and we as patients may need to really raise that awareness and make sure that we're getting the care, or at least the diagnostic investigations that we feel might be indicated given the association that we have with small ruminants.
Thanks so much, Dr. Uhlinger, for sharing this information about these zoonotic disease risks of sheep and goats. Hopefully, this will help some producers to ensure the health and safety both of their flocks or their herds, as well as themselves, their families, and their farm workers. For more information and updates relating to sheep and goat health in Western Canada, producers and veterinarians can join the Small Ruminant Network of the Western Canadian Animal Health Network, and you'll find more information on this online at wecan.ca. Thank you so much.